It's religion today, it's ideology today, and our secularist friends also have a faith.
Some kind of Disneyland fantasy.
I know how this is going to get heard in the secular world.
The pseudo-Christian masks are off.
That's nonsense, ladies and gentlemen.
Apologetics isn't just about giving answers to other people's questions. It's also about learning to question other people's answers or even question the question itself.
In a Christian worldview.
Welcome to Quantum of Solace number 103 and probably around the 9th. It's done with my new deep Barry White voice, but you can cope. Well, we're recording the day after the attacks on Westminster, and what can you say? There are the usual comments that come out. You can almost write the script beforehand that we mustn't blame Islam, that our thoughts and prayers are with those who have been injured. You have the 24-hour news stations desperate for news, speculating and so on. And then you'll have people writing various theodicies and numerous other things. And I don't really want to add to any of that. It is a tragedy. It does strike me that you'll always get as well people saying, well, what about the people who are killed in Syria? Well, I would say that too. But an attack on the heart of democracy for this country is a very serious attack. The fact that one person, it appears, can use a car and a knife to kill four others and possibly yet still more is quite horrific. And I don't know about you, but I switch off the news when these things happen because I hear it. I know what's happened. I have no interest in hearing the details. And I know that every news program is going to be just constant repetition and discussion by experts and desperately seeking for angles. What do we need to know? Somebody was attacked. Somebody was killed. It is part of the human condition. It will happen again, although people say never again. Now, there are always comments and things said, and I don't really want to add to them, and I think it's really wrong, actually, to exploit these situations. But there were two particular type of comment that I think it is worth reflecting on. One are those people who say, well, this was just a false flag operation. I mean, I'm astounded at some of the people who've said this, and one person I know in particular who's very serious and very intelligent, basically saying, how do we know that this wasn't a British government put-up job in order to divert attention from the Scottish independence debate going on at the same time and delay it for one day? Now, for me, it's not even worth responding to that, except to say that it's an indication of how distorted our society has become and how social media, fake news and all the rest of it allows the distortion of our minds and the foolishness of our thinking to come out in these ways. But another example of that is just an astonishing tweet from the radio journalist and broadcaster Julia Hartley Brewer, who stated this: can everyone stop all this pray for London nonsense? It's these bloody stupid beliefs that help create this violence in the first place. Now, this wasn't something tweeted in the emotion that she backed off of. She's gone on to defend it, says she's not saying all religions are the same, says she doesn't understand why people are angry about it. Well, I don't so much about angry. I think we're just stunned at the stupidity of it and how dangerous it is as well. Is it really the case that prayer causes violence and causes these attacks? She is actually lumping all these things. She says that she knows that no God will ever answer any prayer. Well, she doesn't know that. And thankfully, the world is not run on her limited knowledge. I think there is another example of prayer, how real prayer actually works.
Death is always a sad time because it's so final as far as this life is concerned.
Martin McGuinness was one of the leaders of the IRA, almost certainly responsible for many deaths. And yet, at the end of his life, or towards the end of his life, he worked with Ian Paisley, the Reverend Ian Paisley, to bring about the Northern Irish peace process, or at least to ensure that it worked. Now, there are many, many things that we could say about Martin McGuinness, But I would strongly encourage you to do this. We are going to put a link to an interview that was done with Baroness Eileen Paisley, Ian Paisley's widow.
How much credit do you think he should be given for that transformation we've
seen? Well, everybody should be given credit, whatever they do, however small it is. And in saying that, I'm not in any way minimizing the heartbreak that that IRA caused to so many people, and I'm not unaware of the heartbreak that some paramilitaries who call themselves Protestants caused the hearts of many Catholic people. I mean, we all feel the same. Our tears are the same color, and our hearts ache for one another. And we can't get away from those things that have happened. But God is merciful, and he has promised that if we confess our sins to him, that he will forgive us and cleanse us. And that is the greatest forgiveness anyone can know. And people sometimes forget that before the Apostle Paul, the great Apostle Paul, who wrote so much of the New Testament, he stood by. He might not have killed anyone with his own hands, but he brought people, he went around and tortured people and hauled them before the courts of the land so that they would torture them and probably kill them. And he stood, and when Stephen, the first Christian martyr, was murdered, and gave his support to the murder of Stephen. And when God could save a man like the Apostle Paul, who even the disciples of Christ rejected for a long time. They just didn't believe that it was possible for a man like that to be converted. It took them a while to accept that what God had done to Paul. And if God can do that to one man, he can do it to any man or any woman or any young person, whoever they are.
Do you think there's a kind of parallel there in the story of Paul and Martin McGuinness?
Well, Martin didn't get to write any epistles, but God's forgiveness is the same no matter what we do.
And she gave, I think, probably the most moving Christian testimony that I have heard on secular radio, probably ever.
You don't need to lose somebody belonging to you to feel sympathy for other people who have lost. You know, your tears mingle with theirs no matter who they are.
Ian said today, your son Ian today, mm-hmm. said how someone ends their life is
yes.
much more important than how
well,
they began it.
That's true. It's not how you begin, it's how you end.
And yet there are some today, some voices we're hearing already, people who have experienced
yes.
the troubles,
yes.
victims of the troubles,
yes.
who are disappointed, who are frustrated, who are upset that with the passing of Martin McGuinness, perhaps some of the answers they hope to get may have gone with him.
Well, there's a day coming when all answers will be given, William, and we're all to stand before God and give an account of our lives to him, and the whole world will be aware of it then. And this life doesn't end everything. This life begins, after we end this life, eternity begins. And that's the great thing. And there's a God to meet at the end of the day. And we've got to think about that. These things are very, very important. And people need to take a few moments. Some people speak as if they had never had a sinful thought in their minds, and they ought to know better, because none of us is perfect. We can't any of us claim that. And God knows what any of us would have done only for the grace of God.
Her statement was gracious, it was wise, it was realistic. And if you contrast her measured, compassionate, considerate, loving and Christ-centered remarks with the foolishness and crassness of Julie Hartley Brewer, you then see the difference between dark and light. Now let's turn to the Scottish National Party conference. And I don't want to talk about independence, and I don't want to talk about Brexit. But I want to look at two policies in particular. And first, we have to commend the Scottish National Party for a policy that I just did not think would get passed.
This resolution today is to develop a Scottish model on prostitution that decriminalizes the sale of sex, criminalizes the purchase of sex, and offers support to those who wish to exit prostitution.
To criminalize those who pay for sex, but not those who sell it. Now, this is what's called the Nordic model or the Swedish model. It's been done in Northern Ireland. Christian groups such as CARE are big advocates for it, and you can see why.
While this Nordic-style model has been adopted by many of our neighbours, such as Sweden, Norway, France, Iceland, Ireland and Northern Ireland, I know that there are some who disagree with it. Some who believe that this policy would disempower or harm women. But I would urge you seriously to consider this. The fact that a girl who enters prostitution at 14 will service the sexual demands of over 4,000 men before she is old enough to drive a car.
MSP Ash Denham and Katie Forbes and others strongly supported this. I thought that it would be a case that it would not get passed. And yet, it carried because there were those who spoke, including Fiona Broadfoot, who's a former prostitute, or as the correct language now has it, former sex worker, standing to be an SNP councillor.
At the tender age of 15, I had the misfortune to meet a pimp. 2 weeks later, I was thrown into the violent and abusive world of prostitution. I immediately lost my identity, and my already low self-esteem was lost also. I was at immediate risk of extreme sexual violence and abuse. Rape became an occupational hazard, but I was arrested, charged, and criminalised for loitering for the purposes of being a common prostitute. I liken my day-to-day life like being on the front lines of a battlefield. I spent the next 11 years shut down and disassociated. I suppressed feelings of shame and disgust constantly by telling myself that this was a job like any other. After one particular bad experience of being brutally raped for several hours by a sex buyer, I remember stepping into the shower, scrubbing myself and repeating in my head, "It's like falling off a horse. Just pull yourself together and get back on." And innocent women would be raped if it wasn't for me. I was 17 years old. Within an hour, I'd returned to the street corner, accompanied by my pimp, whom I only ever referred to as my boyfriend.
Interestingly enough, our secularists and humanists seem to be opposed to this. They want to decriminalise all sex. They want sex to be sold. And they like the idea of sex workers and all the rest of it.
Being bought and sold ended abruptly when I heard the news that my 17-year-old cousin had been murdered by a sex-buying man. This burst a bubble I had created to cope with the constant violence and abuse I was experiencing. No longer could I convince myself that this was a job like any other. That was 22 years ago. However, I am still haunted by my experiences.
We know from a Christian perspective where this is coming from, and we know where it goes. And that's why we've ended up with sex trafficking and so on. It's coming from sin, basically. It's coming from lust. People who have money thinking they can buy particularly women's bodies, or men can be prostitutes as well. It's coming from greed, seeking to exploit. It's also coming from desperation. There is no way that any society with any sense of morality should be seeking to encourage prostitution. I've even heard one person argue that sex workers should be an option at schools' career fairs. So well done to the SNP for passing that, and let's hope that your government enacts it.
Finish up now, please.
Support the resolution for Scotland. This will eventually end demand and create a better society for all. Thank you.
Now let's move on to something else, which initially you look at and you say, well, well done for that as well. And that is the giving every child the best start in life, and in particularly nursery schools. What the SNP decided to do at their conference, or what was announced by the First Minister, actually, was that the living wage would be paid to every nursery worker.
In public sector nurseries, staff already receive the living wage, but there are currently around 1,000 private nurseries helping to deliver our free childcare policy, and currently around 80% of the childcare staff who work in them don't earn the living wage. That's 8,000 people in total. there are few more important jobs than caring for our youngest children. So I can announce today that by the end of this Parliament, we will invest £50 million to ensure that all staff working in private nurseries delivering our childcare pledge are paid the real living wage.
In one sense, that's good, and yet in another sense, it's bad. At two levels. At a minor level, I have an objection to the state paying private companies to pay their workers a decent wage. The private company themselves will, of course, be making substantial profits. So the private company should be paying the living wage, not the state. But there's a much deeper issue and a much more profound issue, and it's simply this. Nicola Sturgeon recognised that children need looking after. That's the bottom line.
There are few more important jobs than caring for our youngest children.
That they need a stable environment in which to grow up.
But we know that life chances are far too often determined before a child even starts school.
But if the solution is just nurseries, then you can see what's happening there. I think God has given a solution for that, and that's the family. Now, some families will be dysfunctional. We know that. Some families, because of work patterns and so on, are going to need childcare. But it should still be the case that the state does not come in and say, we're going to look after your children for you. What every child needs more than anything else is a good, stable home environment with a father and a mother. Now, one of the problems is, of course, our society is saying, no, that's not really necessary as long as they've got somewhere to go. But that's not true. Now, I'm not decrying nurseries, and I'm not saying we shouldn't have them, and I'm not saying Christians shouldn't use them. But I am saying any parent who hands over the responsibility of bringing up their children to the state, to nurseries, to schools, whatever, is a parent who's not fulfilling their God-ordained role. I know it's difficult being a parent. I am one. I know it's difficult, but we need to get back to that or our society is going to be in an even bigger mess. And the trouble with what the government is proposing is that it's good in the same way as when you go to the doctor and the doctor gives you a pill or you get a sticking plaster. But it's not good because it doesn't deal with the root cause of the problem. Again, there's an interesting thing that happened at the Scottish Government, which in all the fuss about independence may have been missed. The Scottish Government, and it appears the opposition parties are all going along with this, that a bill is being introduced to criminalise psychological abuse, particularly in homes, in marriages, and so on. Now, it seems great. Outlawing psychological and emotional abuse in intimate relationships. And the reason they're all going along with it, of course, is because they say, well, of course, abuse is wrong. And if you say you're opposed to this bill, then you're saying abuse is right, because that's the binary black and white world in which we live. Except it's not. Here's the problem. In the real world, the Justice Minister, Michael Matheson, when asked to define the problem, couldn't. And that's the difficulty. What is psychological abuse? Checking a partner's access to social media. So if my wife goes to check my access to social media, is she psychologically abusing me? Apparently it could be. Having a controlling personality. Well, I don't want to talk about my mother, but, you know, I mean, come on, you're kidding me. How are you going to prosecute people for that? Things like unreasonable behavior, but that's already grounds for divorce. So again, how are you going to criminalize that? Are teenagers going to be able to prosecute parents for unreasonable controlling behavior when they're grounded? You don't give them the Wi-Fi password. Now, domestic abuse is a terrible crime. And actually, psychological abuse, you could argue, is just as bad. But for the state, this is paradise for lawyers. But I think it's a dreadful, dreadful thing. Because when people are accused of it, how do you even defend yourself? How do you even prove it? No, Ian McWhirter has an article that we'll link to that explains the problems with it. But will our government listen? No, not a chance. I don't think there is. And in, I suppose, what's almost now become a weekly slot, where do we go next? Well, how about mother and son becoming father and daughter? We'll put a link to it if you're interested in reading about it. After last week, we linked to the New Zealand weightlifter male who's now winning weightlifting competitions, and of course, women are complaining about it. The end of women's sport may not be serious to some, though I think it is actually, and the mass confusion about changing sexual identity at a whim, again, may not be interesting to some, but I think it is. But this is really serious. The BBC carried a news item about a rapist being moved to a woman-only prison after having gender reassignment surgery. A man called Martin Ponting, who was jailed for vicious rapes, has decided that he is now Jessica Winfield. He was serving a life sentence at Whitemore Prison in Cambridgeshire. A life sentence indicates how serious the charges against him were. But now she's complaining, well, he's complaining that she's now a she, and that having a hard time because of my sexuality, wrote to the Times and so on. I've changed my name to that of a female to prove to the authorities and everyone concerned I'm very serious about my gender and I do not feel right being a man. One of the victims says this: "There are not enough words to describe him and the evil he has done. It is diabolical they've allowed him to have a sex change and diabolical that he could be freed this year. He may have changed physically, but his brain is still the same." Now, it's extraordinary. The sex change operation, by the way, was funded by the NHS, whilst there are people struggling in the NHS to get decent treatment and support and recovery. I'm sorry, but it's almost like, what can you say to such stupidity? And yes, I'm sorry, but it is such evil. But that's the path we're on. Now, remember how we've said before and been criticised for suggesting that liberalism might not be all that liberal? Well, here's another proof. Tim Keller, you know, that well-known right-wing fascistic theocrat, Mr. Keller, you know, Donald Trump's right-hand man, the alt-right pastor. No, you haven't heard of him. No. Oh, well, the other Tim Keller, the one of the leading preachers in the world, one of the leading Christian intellects, pastor of Redeemer Church in New York, he was about to be honored by Princeton Theological Seminary. Princeton Theological Seminary. And that honor has been withdrawn. Why? Because he belongs to a denomination, the Presbyterian Church of America, which does not ordain practicing homosexuals and does not ordain women. And so therefore, he must be excluded, says Princeton. Now, you see, when you get all these people going, we need to have a dialogue and we need to have variety and we need to have diversity of opinion. Look, guys, this is where it leads you. They always say, yes, 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 let's allow difference. But what starts off as permission soon becomes determinative, that if you don't follow them, you're out. Now, of course, Tim will respond with his usual graciousness, and he's still able to go and speak there, which he will do. But you want an example of the illiberalism of liberalism? And actually, Princeton, you need to read Gresham Machen's Christianity and Liberalism, because he describes them as two different religions. And if you've never read that book, read it, because what he said then is still absolutely true today. Christianity and liberal Christianity are two different religions. And then finally, we lost another great, in one sense, Chuck Berry, who's been called the father of rock and roll, the founder of modern rock and roll, which he undoubtedly was. I've got a couple of Chuck Berry albums, love his music, but hey, please, guys, don't eulogize him. What's the song? It's a teenage wedding and the old folks wish them well. You know what that song's about? Something for which he went to jail, absconding with a teenager across a county line for sex. No, you can appreciate the music and you can admire aspects of someone's life. People's lives are always complicated. And Berry, I don't know, there's just something I found quite disturbing about the eulogizing of him and the covering over of his faults. And it's a little bit like there are people just now who I saw eulogizing Chuck Berry who condemn Donald Trump for his disgusting remarks, and so they should, for his disgusting remarks about women a while ago. But they're never, ever going to forget that. But somehow, Chuck Berry, all's forgiven. I think we live in quite a hypocritical society in that respect. Which is why it's always good to return to the good news and to return to the gospel, because in Christ there is no hypocrisy and there is no falsehood. And if we have any glory at all, it is only because it's reflective of His. And with that thought, we shall leave you till next week.
Yo. We're part of a culture that really loves to hate us. Every chance they get attempt to isolate and debate us. It's not that they don't like us, it's just they don't like God in us. It's common knowledge and oddly enough, but makes a lot of sense to a lot of us. We completely understand because we used to occupy the same space and lived in a similar type state until we tasted of God's grace. So we continue loving this world that so easily rejects us and passionately press past the lack of their cultural acceptance. And as if there weren't enough problems for us gaining influence, we keep fighting over the issue of what's too worldly of a Christian to make a difference. So no matter how you paint it or politically campaign it, whether you water it down and drain it, it's really all the same, ain't it? It's the same frustration, same constant segregation. Christians living like aliens trying to relate with citizens of a different nation. What always makes for a better presentation than bark and bite is a proper understanding of living life filled with salt and light. So we walk this fine line of walking in light of God's kindness and live with a sense of worldliness without the fear of compromising. Loving God and neighbor until Christ comes to split the sky or die in a society hailing Jesus as Messiah. Yep.